Welcome to Meet the Writers. I'm Georgina Godwin. My guest today suffered a brain hemorrhage and was in a coma for a fortnight. At the time, her latest book, Conrad and Eleanor, was a manuscript she'd started 10 years earlier and couldn't finish. She picked it up again during her convalescence in order to get back into writing and finished it in record time. It's just been published. Her first book was published 33 years ago, and in between the two, she's written seven other novels, winning many of the major prizes for fiction and being longlisted for the Man Booker along the way. She also writes short stories, screenplays, radio drama, and she's taught writing to a wide range of students across the world. She's a fellow of the Royal Society of Literature. Jane Rogers, welcome to Meet the Writers. Now, my guest a couple of weeks ago was Jill Dawson, and she said that what she most wished for before she was published was the chance to have a one-on-one intensive session with you, and that your writing had taught her a tremendous amount about the craft.
What an amazing thing for her to say. I'm deeply honoured.
Well, I know that you actually do teach together now, but I wondered if in the way that Jill needed you, if there was someone that you needed right at the beginning, if you had a first mentor or even a book that made you aware of your desire to write.
Well, as you said, you know, my first book was published 33 years ago. Now, if you look back at the writing climate 33 years ago, there were not the courses, there was not the emphasis on being taught writing. I mean, when I wanted to be a writer, and I wanted to be a writer from a very young age, I thought it was just something that you had to find within yourself. I didn't think of anybody else teaching me. It wasn't in the air that people taught people writing, really. And I was writing stories from, you know, from when I learnt to write at school. I mean, I very much encouraged by my father, I have to say. But I mean, I do remember I wrote a story, you know, at primary school that was entered into some local newspaper competition and it won. And I always wanted to write. I always thought I would write. I didn't really, I'm sure I would have benefited hugely if there had been a great critic who'd read it and given me feedback. But I wasn't thinking in those terms, really.
You mentioned your father and the theme of motherhood, or I suppose parenthood, really, weaves through a lot of your work. And I wondered about your relationship with your own mother.
I think now my relationship with my mother is excellent. She's 87, she lives in Australia, and she's extremely active and intelligent and completely all there and has a better memory than I do and is a great, great reader. And certainly I got that from my parents, an absolute reverence for books, a love of books, an assumption that you would always have a book on the go. So that definitely comes from my parents. In terms of my relationship with my mother, I think I probably behaved in a rather classic girl way, which is to say that when I was a kid, I found my mum a bit embarrassing, She had five children and she stayed at home and looked after us. I thought that was quite poor. I thought she should be out there, you know, in the world of work. I thought I would never, ever be like that. I didn't want to be like that. I think I was not nice to her when I was in my teens. And I think when I grew up, I realised what I'd got. Mm. And now we do have a good relationship. Well, we have had.
Because you explore that a bit indirectly in your Booker-nominated work, and that's The Testament of Jessie Lamb. It looks at intergenerational conflict.
Yes, and it's extremely acute of you to have landed on the mother thing, because I will tell you this now. For a while I kept it kind of secret to myself, but my mother knows about it now. My mum is one of my greatest fans, and she lives in Australia, so I have to ring her up or Skype her to find out what she thinks of the latest book. And when she read Jessie Lamb, and I Skyped her, and I said, "So what do you think?" She said, "I didn't like it." I said, "Mum, you didn't like it?" She said, "No, I didn't like it. She's a stupid girl. She's a really stupid, selfish girl. Didn't like it. What a selfish girl." And I was, you know, I was a bit appalled, really. And then, you know, we had a conversation, and the conversation moved on to other things. And after a bit, I went on thinking about it, and I couldn't really figure out why she was so against the book. And then I had a conversation with a really close friend who's known me, you know, pretty much all my life. And she said, "But for your mum, Jessie's like you were, isn't she?" I suddenly thought, bloody hell, I honestly hadn't realised that I was reproducing that relationship. And of course, Jessie's mum is a doctor and I mean, is not in any way like my mother. But the difficult relationship between the two, yeah.
But what she and your father did do, as you say, is engender this love of reading. And in fact, you went on to be an English teacher.
Yes, that wasn't... I didn't particularly want to be an English teacher. I mean, I wanted to be a writer. And the only other thing I ever really wanted to be was an actor. For a while, I wanted to be an actor more than I wanted to be a writer. But I was persuaded that it would be better to get a degree and then be an actor rather than just go to drama school. And, of course, the plan to deflect me from being an actor worked extremely well because I did a degree and then I wanted to be a writer. But I was aware that it's hard to make money as a writer, so I thought I would have to do something else. And it was a question of figuring out what I could do. And I did various things. I was a surveyor's assistant for a housing association for a while, and I had a few other odd jobs. And then I finally decided, well, you be a teacher because at least you've got, and everyone who's listening who's a teacher will laugh hollowly, at least you've got long holidays and short working hours. So then I did teacher training and I taught for 3 years and I didn't have any time at all to write and I nearly went mad.
And so was there a defining moment then when you thought, now I am an author?
Well, what I thought, I mean, I wanted to write and I had had stories published while I was at university. My first thing that was ever published in something that was grown up that wasn't a university publication, I had a story in Spare Rib, the feminist magazine, and I was very proud of that. That was my first, I regard that as my first proper publication. That happened while I was at university. But I thought I couldn't really count myself as an author until I'd published a novel, because that's what I wanted to do. So what happened really in the third year of teaching was that I realised, okay, I can teach, but it uses up every ounce of me. There's nothing left for writing. I'm going to leave this and I'm going to write a novel in a year and I'm going to bloody do it. And I certainly can't call myself a writer until I've done that.
And you did.
Well, I did, actually.
33 years ago, actually, as we now know.
No, it wasn't that straightforward. It didn't happen immediately. I wrote it and it was far too long and blousy and big and I thought it was no good, so I put it away. And I did then get a half-time teaching post and continued to teach. And I didn't cut that novel until I got pregnant. And that was what finally galvanised me into cutting it and being quite ruthless with it and sending it off, you know, to a deadline, like, you know, OK, the baby's going to be born next week, put it in the post. And so that's what happened.
And after that, you felt that was it. You were on the way. That's you as a published author and you stopped teaching altogether?
No, I've never stopped teaching. Well, I've never stopped teaching.
You teach writing, of course.
Yes, yeah. Exactly. What happened, because you don't make enough money from novels to live for very long at all, unless you're lucky or exceptional. I've always continued to, at that period, I continued to teach English either part-time or supply or for evening classes or, you know, in different ways in which I could fit it in so that I had some writing time as well.
You explore a range of first-person voices in your writing. And I wondered about feeling if you inhabit those people and how hard it is to shake them off.
You do inhabit them, definitely. And I think, I used to think it was because I wanted to be an actor, but now I've talked to enough other writers, I think it's actually very common that when you are writing a character, you find elements of that character within yourself. No matter how extreme or even evil that character is, you find elements in yourself and you push them. And that's how you understand it. That's how you get under the skin. So, I mean, I've never had the experience that some people talk about, oh, you know, the character took me over or the character's voice was speaking and I was just carried away with it. I mean, I'm always, unfortunately, it's always work. I'm always conscious. But the thing of actually getting into a character's voice, I think, is key for me. And the best way I can describe that is if I talk about Mr. Rose Virgins, which is the novel of mine that contains the most voices. There's four first-person female voices in that. And if you look at the novel now, you see they're all intercut. There's one chapter for one woman, one chapter for the next, and so on. But when I wrote it, I had to write each voice from beginning to end because my head wouldn't do chop and change from Martha's voice to Hannah's or from Leah's voice to Joanna's. I had to properly get into a voice. So it was written in a very different way than it is finally structured.
Do you think that's why it works so well on television?
I don't know.
I mean, it did work very well on TV, didn't it? Did you actually, you wrote the TV script too?
I did write the TV script. And to be honest, by that point, I was just completely wedded to the intercut voices. But we had long discussions about how it could be adapted. We were given 4 hours, which obviously is incredibly generous. You'd never get that now. We were given 4 hours, but how do you divide a novel into 4 one-hour chunks? And for the dramatisation, the model that I took, I didn't really think about the fact that I'd written the voices end-to-end. I thought of that incredible TV play by John Hopkins, Talking to a Stranger. It's one of the classics of television drama. It's completely brilliant. I saw it when I was young. I mean, in my teens, it was first broadcast. But it's called Talking to a Stranger, and it's Judi Dench's first television role. And it's four members of a family, a mother and a father and a son and a daughter, who are grown up. And the mother kills herself. But the way that the drama is structured is that the first one is from, I can't remember which order they were, but say the daughter's point of view, the second is from the son's point of view, the third from the father, and the fourth finally from the mother's. So you see that day from each character's perspective. And so each programme that you watch, you understand more of the family dynamic. And that seemed to me such a brilliant piece of drama. Mm. And I thought, well, I've got four characters, I'll do that. I'll do it like that.
Mm. And it's a technique you've used actually quite a lot in your work.
For me, that was a really seminal play to see.
Now, you're a really accomplished teacher, as we were saying. And I wonder about guiding other people's stories and how that impacts on your own work. Can you get crowded out by other people's creativity, if you like?
Your time can get crowded out. You know, I've resigned from my post at Sheffield Hallam University, and that has opened up a great deal of time in the last year, which has been excellent. Your time can get crowded out. I don't think it particularly crowds out your own ability to have ideas. I would say perhaps almost the opposite, because it's usually quite stimulating. I mean, you're talking to other people who care about writing. If their ideas are good, then that's interesting and you engage with them, and that, you know, ideas feed ideas. If their ideas are bad, if their writing is dull, that's the only thing that used to worry me sometimes, was, you know, that bad writing might be catching. No, but you know what I mean? Because I love to read. And if you read a lot of stuff which is really mediocre, it deadens your ear a bit.
You've put together, though, an anthology of fantastic writing, the Oxford University Press's Good Fiction Guide. In your introduction, you quote Orwell. You say, good prose is like a window pane.
Well, it is.
But I wonder, looking through that, how you chose what was in the book.
Well, I mean, the brief was that it should be a guide which would cover, you know, the classics, the best of contemporary fiction, and, you know, things that I would particularly recommend. Obviously, as the editor, I didn't read everything. I didn't write all the entries. I appointed the writers and I read everything that they wrote, and obviously dealt with it when I wasn't happy. But in terms of the books that we covered, I think, you know, I wouldn't say that it was by any means just my selection. I had an assistant editor, and also the people who I asked to write the entries had their own ideas about, for example, the best book by the writers that they were doing, and so on and so forth. Mm. So that certainly wasn't just me by any means. A lot of people contributed to that gigantic effort.
Mm. Yeah, a huge project. And you also write screenplays, as we've said, and radio plays. And you recently adapted Dodie Smith's I Capture the Castle. Well, talking about huge projects, given that it's so beloved by so many people, I mean, I think almost everyone I know says it's in their top five books. Mm. That must have been quite a daunting prospect.
It was lovely. It was so lovely to adapt something which is funny. Because, you've read my books, you'll realise that although I appreciate humour, I'm not exactly a comic writer. I'm quite serious. And I really, really loved adapting something funny. It was just a joy from beginning to end. And it was so great in studio when we were recording it. And the actors were laughing. They were laughing at the lines. And I was thinking, God, this is good. You know, why can't I write more funny stuff?
You were involved in a drama series in Uganda. I'm very interested in that. What was it?
Well, yes, I set it up. Okay, it's a long, complicated story, so I'll try to put it in a bit of a nutshell. Where I was professor of writing at Sheffield Hallam, I taught on the MA course. One of my students on the MA course was a delightful Ugandan woman called Atuki Turner. And she had set up in Uganda, in the area that she came from, a charity to campaign against bride price, because many of the abuses that were inflicted on women in rural Uganda are caused by bride price. Because if a man pays for a woman, for a wife, it's like paying to buy an ox or something. You expect it to work. And if it doesn't work, you get mad and you maybe beat it or kick it out. So anyway, there must have been conversations between Atuki and myself about how to help people to understand that bride price was a bad thing, because obviously it's culturally very embedded. And it came to me that maybe radio might be a way of communicating that in a rural area, because there are a number of other famous radio dramas which are broadcast, particularly in Africa actually, which aim to tackle things like giving information about AIDS or giving information about girls' education. So the model, the original model for this, as quite a lot of people know, is the Archers, to tell people about farming. So, or to tell farmers about new improvements in farming, rather. Basically, I applied for funding and we set up a workshop there, which I led for a fortnight, teaching four or five young Ugandan people who are interested in writing to storyline and to produce five episodes of a 15-minute radio drama. And we did that. And then a producer who I've worked with in England came out to Uganda and we recorded it to professional level, but with local people performing the parts and in, you know, not in studio, in situ, in the village and so on. And it worked. It was fine. It was good. And the local radio station broadcast it. And then they went on with the storylines that we'd worked out and the characters that we'd worked out. They went on and wrote 40 more episodes of their own and recorded them and broadcast them, which made me incredibly proud. And they did a fantastic job.
Let's come now to your latest book, Conrad and Eleanor. Now, I say latest, but as we heard at the top, the book was actually started a long time ago. You abandoned it in 2004. Tell me what happened.
Well, I mean, when I started it, I was interested in writing a story about a long marriage. And I had their characters. I knew exactly what Conrad and Eleanor were both like. And I knew that I wanted them to be scientists. And I did a lot of research into their respective areas of scientific expertise. I wanted them to be scientists for several reasons, some of which are good and some of which might not be. Probably the one that's not very good is that I really needed them to not be me. And I'm not a scientist and neither is my husband. So it's nothing to do with us, this book. But also I'm very interested in science and I come from a family of scientists who often tell me fascinating things. And I'm also really interested in the idea of exploring a job where you're making quite tough ethical choices in what you're doing. So I did all the research, and all the science in this book is completely accurate. I did all the research and I got cracking on the story and I got about halfway through and I couldn't push my way through to an end. I couldn't see how it could end, really. And it seemed to me that every kind of ending that I started to work towards or started to imagine was melodramatic. So I got just completely disheartened in the end and I gave up on it and I wrote The Testament of Jesse Lamb, using some of the scientific research, actually, in that book.
And then you came back to it 10 years later.
I did. I came back to it because, as you said, I was ill and nobody really, I mean, doctors and neither the doctors nor I were very clear on how useful my brain was.
So you'd had a brain hemorrhage and you were in a coma for a couple of weeks?
But then I, you know, very fortunately, I made a remarkably quick recovery. And I started writing for an hour a day to really to see if I still could or, you know, if I was writing anything worth reading.
Terrifying, I imagine.
Well, do you know what? It wasn't really terrifying for me. It was much more terrifying for everybody else. Because they were all scared. Obviously, my family and my friends were scared for me. And, I was out of it. It didn't hurt. I didn't have any pain. I didn't have, you know, and then when I woke up, I was exceedingly irritable with them all because I thought they were making a tremendous fuss and over-dramatising it. And it took me about 6 months to understand that I had nearly died. I just didn't believe it.
Mm-hmm.
Because you don't. I just thought, well, what's the fuss about? Anyway, I took out Conrad and Eleanor again and started it because I didn't have any new ideas and I still had those characters very much in my head. And I thought, well, I can just almost like an exercise, I can do an hour of this because I can write about them. I like writing about them. But then, you know, an hour increased to 2 hours, to 3 hours, to 4 hours. And then I was writing it, and by September it was finished.
Amazing. So much quicker than you would normally do a novel,
yeah.
In fact.
Yeah.
Were there any other effects, do you think, that you noticed in how you changed? You wrote faster. This is clearly a wonderful book. Was there anything else?
There are a few bad things. My family reckon I've become much more hard-hearted. And mean. which may be true, because I think I've never been the world's most patient person, but I think I've probably got less patience now, because I think I have a bit got a feeling of, well, you know, I'd better get on with the things I want to do.
But you talked about how it focuses on a long-standing and a slowly evolving marriage. And in fact, I've seen you write that The Winter's Tale was quite an inspiration. And in fact, you bring in the daughter performing The Winter's Tale, which I thought was a wonderful touch. You also play with ideas of gender role reversal. The woman in the book, Eleanor, really takes on the masculine role in lots of ways.
Yes, she does. And I was interested in doing that. I was interested in doing that because I think over the last 30, 40 years, you know, when I was a student, when I was young, I was a feminist. All my friends were feminists. We all thought the world was changing. We thought, you know, that we were absolutely going to be equal and we were going to have equality. And in many ways, that's gone backwards. And so I wanted to take what seems to me to be the core thing over which men and women divide, which is childcare. Because, you know, children are the next generation and still children are nearly completely raised by women, despite all sorts of generous attempts to give men paternity leave and so on and so forth. The way that our society is structured means that still women are the main carers for children. Mm. And from that, all sorts of inequalities spring. So I was interested in creating a couple, both of whom were highly intelligent, both of whom were capable of having very high-powered jobs, but making the man more nurturing and more inclined to spend time with the children and making the woman more ambitious and a bit tougher and more inclined to pursue her career. And I was interested in doing that, firstly to see how it would pan out between the two of them, but also to see how the rest of the world would judge both of them, because it seemed to me, before I started, that on the whole, society judges women who do that more harshly than men are ever judged. Mm. And also that, to a degree, men who are more nurturing are sometimes not criticised exactly, but very slightly patronised or thought of as maybe wimps or not quite macho.
There's a lot of contempt about, isn't there? A lot of, you're not manly enough.
In some cases. And I mean, even if you just take away the way that people react to it, if you just think about the facts. I mean, my husband and I shared childcare of our children, and we're both writers, so that was easy for us, and I appreciate it does depend on your job. But when our children were little, when my husband used to take them to playgroup when I was writing, he was the only dad. And now, when we take our grandchildren to playgroup, he's quite often the only man, still.
The couple of scientists, and they're in similar but different areas of work. So Eleanor works on stem cell research. Conrad's work has become increasingly irrelevant.
And that's something which the 10-year gap really, really gave me, very interestingly. Because, of course, when I picked it up, and once I decided I was serious about finishing it and doing it in 2014, I thought, well, this is ridiculous. I can't try to publish a novel set in 2003. Nobody, you know, that's so random. People all think it's weird. I'll have to update it. And I started trying to update the science, and then I realised that I couldn't, Because in those 10 years, his line of research, which I was implying in the book was becoming overtaken, had been completely overtaken.
And it was on transplant rejection.
Yes. Basically, there aren't enough spare hearts to replace the hearts of people who need them, people who've got faulty hearts and heart disease. So there was a line of research which was pursuing the possibility of creating hearts from animals which could be transplanted into people. And the original research behind that was transplanting transgenic pig hearts into monkeys. And the idea was that it would be possible to develop transgenic pig hearts in such a way that they could eventually be transplanted into people. And that's what Conrad was researching. Mm-hmm. Now, that research has been overtaken by stem cell research, which has, and scientists will curl up to hear me describe it so crudely, but basically the idea is that you can use a person's own stem cells to begin to grow an organ which could replace their own heart. And then you would escape all the problems of rejection. Mm. So one day it'll work and it will be great.
So, of course, this allows you to examine in the book the issue of vivisection. And the book presents arguments really on both sides of the debate. I mean, I like the fact that you're not banging the drum for animal rights, but at the same time you are telling us some pretty dreadful things going on in labs.
Yes, it's true. I mean, again, the research is accurate. Yes, I'm not interested in writing a book to bang a drum about anything. And it seems to me that one of the reasons why, you know, a scientist's job, and in particular poor old Conrad's job, is so incredibly hard is because, you know, he's a man who thinks and is intensely sympathetic to both humans and animals. He knows that he's causing suffering to animals, but he knows that if it will work, he will save the lives of children. Mm. And that's, you know, who wants to have to make that decision when they go to work every day? It's painful. There's no point in me saying one is right and one is wrong. And anyway, I don't even know which is right or wrong.
I mean, his son, interestingly, in the book, Paul, accuses him of being a speciesist.
Yes, yes.
Human life more valuable than animal life. Finally, it is about marriage. That's at the very core of the book. And it's not what Eleanor imagined it to be. And she's disappointed that she says you start off young imagining you can do anything, but you end up just like everyone else. And she feels that there's an illusion of choice, but no real choice, just a narrowing funnel. And I wondered if your funnel is narrow and what's next for you?
Okay, well, I'm going to argue with both parts of that. Because in the book, I do say that sometimes she thinks that. It seems to me that sometimes as you get older, yes, you think everything's narrowing down and, oh God, I'm only heading, you know, it's a one-way street and what's at the end of it is not very nice, you know, misery. But then, you know, at other times you think, my God, it's incredible. I know so many things now and I feel confident and I am so interested by X, Y, and Z and I know what I'm interested in. I don't have to waste time on other things and it's absolutely amazing being alive. So, no, I won't go down the narrowing funnel. Well, just yet, thank you.
What's coming up? What's your next project?
I'm currently really enjoying adapting two Robert Louis Stevenson novellas for classic serial for radio. So that's what I'm working on at the moment.
But right now, Conrad and Eleanor, which is published by Atlantic Books, is out now. Jane Rogers, thank you so much for talking to me.
Thank you for your lovely questions.
You've been listening to Meet the Writers. Thanks to sound engineer and editor Toby Hammond. You can download the show and previous episodes from our website or from our app, from SoundCloud, Mixcloud or iTunes. I'm Georgina Godwin. Thank you for listening.